Hi, and welcome to Failureology, a podcast about engineering failures. I'm your host, Nicole.
And I'm Brian, and we're both from Calgary, Alberta, Canada. Welcome to our 33rd mini failure episode.
We're bringing you engineering failures in bite-sized pieces.
Make no mistake, though, these are still significant failures or just things we find are interesting to talk about, but they either have pretty straightforward causes or not enough information available for a full episode.
These episodes are also just the failure, no news, and no ads, for now at least.
It's like Failureology Lite.
Happy New Year, Failureologists. We have made it to 2023.
In honor of episode 33, I figured I would take a look and see what interesting things, facts, existed about the number 33. The most interesting one that I found, which may not be the most interesting one to you, was that 33 is the number of innings in the longest professional baseball game ever played, which happened in 1981 between the Rochester Red Wings and the Pawtucket Red Sox in Pawtucket, Rhode Island. It is also the number that's printed on all Rolling Rock beer labels.
And for all the non-baseball fans out there, Brian, how many innings does a baseball game normally have?
9.
So 33 is a lot more.
I've attended a baseball game that had 16 innings in it, which was actually pretty good. And then I've watched some 20-plus inning games, which are also really good. There was one a few years ago where I thought I was going to miss the baseball game. I came home, and it was the 10th inning. I was like, oh, perfect. At least I can watch some of this game. And then I believe that one was 20-plus innings. It was great. It was extra baseball I didn't even think I would get to watch.
I'm curious how long 33 innings would take to play. How long would that baseball game have been? 4 hours? 8 hours? It's got to be longer than four.
So typically 9 innings of baseball is about 3 hours long. So that game would have been just under 11 hours to play.
Oh my God.
Which is a really, really long time to play. I haven't looked at the box score for this game, but I'm guessing that there were a lot of positional players that wound up pitching. The game quality, once you got later on, probably wasn't that great. But it did set the record for the longest professional baseball game, even though it was between two minor league teams. 33 innings is a really long baseball game. That's almost four full baseball games that were played.
Yeah, that's a lot. Too much for me.
And probably one of the worst parts, I don't know, back in the 1980s, but now beer sales stop before the end of the ninth inning. I believe it's the seventh inning or eighth inning beer sales stop. So that's a lot of beer-free baseball that people would have had to watch if they stuck around at the end.
Great point.
On to this week's mini failure about the Sudbury effect. This is the last in our series about environmental disasters that we've done the last few episodes of mini failures.
And we saved it for last because it has a bit of a happy ending. So far, we've talked about the Love Canal, Minamata, Bhopal, asbestos, PFOA or C8 contamination, also known as the DuPont scandal. And now, last episode, we are going to talk about the Sudbury effect, which, like I mentioned, is a bit of a positive story. This is the story of Sudbury's re-greening and how they overcame decades of pollution. So we thought this was a good one to end this series on.
So for those of you not familiar with Canadian geography or Northern Ontario geography, Sudbury is a town in Northern Ontario. It's about 400 kilometers north of Toronto. It's a fairly industrial town. There's lots of mining activity that goes on in the town and smelting activity, which we'll talk about later on in this episode. During the construction of the Canadian Pacific Railway in 1883, there were high concentrations of nickel copper ore that were discovered near Sudbury at Murray Mine, which is right on the edge of the Sudbury Basin. And the railway that was being built and continues to operate now allowed mining people in the area to exploit these resources and ship them to markets and different ports nationally and internationally within North America and outside of North America. The nickel ore is smelted, which entails adding heat to the ore to extract a base metal, which is the nickel. And then that's used for the production of various things later on down the product life cycle. So some of the things that are made out of nickel include Canadian nickels, which are a 5-cent coin with a beaver on them. These are currently nickel plated from 1922 to 1942. And from 1946 to 1981, nickels were made with 99.9% nickel. In other years, they've been made of copper, steel, silver, zinc, and chrome of various compositions.
Which I thought was interesting that nickel isn't actually, the nickel isn't actually made of nickel. I think currently it's nickel plated, which is kind of sad. Although it would be kind of weird if it was made of nickel that was worth more than the 5 cents that is on the nickel.
Which I believe has happened with some other coins where the value of the material the coin was made out of was worth more than the actual value of the coin. I want to say it was silver dollars, but I'm not 100% sure that's what it was.
Yeah, I've heard about that as well. So the smelting process to extract the nickel itself blanketed the area of Sudbury in sulfur dioxide and metals, emitting upwards of 2.5 million tons per year. And the sulfur dioxide acidified the soil, rain, and lakes, resulting in a complete loss of vegetation, leaving barren rolling hills and blackened rock. Soon, mining replaced lumber as the primary industry, and local trams also facilitated workers commuting so they could live in one place and work in another. Two mining companies were formed in the early 1900s in Sudbury: Inco, now known as Vale Canada Limited, in 1902, and Falconbridge, now Glencore Xstrata, in 1928, both becoming major employers and two of the world's leading producers of nickel. Mining went through boom-bust cycles over the years, as do most industries, often following wartime demands. Fun fact, Sudbury recovered from the Great Depression faster than almost any other North American city because of the demand for nickel in the 1930s. And they actually had more issues keeping up with economic growth than with unemployment or poverty. But Sudbury was ordered into receivership by the Ontario Municipal Board from 1936 to 1941 due to a number of problems they were having. Luckily, fortunes rose again during the Second World War, with the Froude mine accounting for 40% of the nickel use in Allied artillery during the war and again offering nickel to the U.S. during the Cold War stockpile.
So along with all that mining came air pollution and acid rain, like Nicole mentioned. The pollution and acid rain have caused staining that penetrates up to 75 millimeters, or about 3 inches if you're not on the metric system, into the pink-gray granite in the area around Sudbury. Also, it acidified 300 lakes nearby. Like, that's a lot of lakes that received acid rain and became uninhabitable to plant species and fish species, and also impacted flora and fauna around the lakes. In addition to this, Inco built a superstack in 1972, which dispersed sulfuric acid throughout the area. It is the second tallest structure in Canada after the CN Tower, the tallest chimney in the Western Hemisphere, and the second tallest freestanding chimney in the world after the GRES-2 power station in Kazakhstan. I did not know that a chimney was the second tallest tower in Canada after the CN Tower. That's actually quite remarkable.
I think we all know the Calgary Tower is not anywhere near the top of that list.
I mean, the Calgary Tower isn't even the tallest building in Calgary. I think it's not like the 10th shot. Or 12th tallest. Like, it's you can go up to the observation deck on the Calgary Tower and you can look out over all the buildings that are taller than it. When it was built, I believe, in 1972, it was, I believe, the tallest structure at that point. But that didn't last very long, and now there's many more buildings that are taller than it, including this chimney. So the Inco stack was decommissioned in July 2020 and reduced emissions by 85% and cut the complex's natural gas consumption in half.
The stack was supposed to be demolished by now, but word on the street is the contract has not been awarded yet for that demolition work.
Hopefully that happens soon. Also in the 1970s, the municipality, province, Inco, and academics from Laurentian University started a recovery program called the Regreening Effort. This project included spreading lime over charred soil by hand and aircraft to neutralize the acidity. Then they spread seeds for wild grass, trees, and other vegetation.
So just to recap a little bit, we've got acid rain, the granite is being stained black, the lakes are acidified. And so let's just, if those things are all happening to the natural environment, imagine what the air quality is like, what the water quality is like, and what overall quality of life is like for all of the people that are living in this area. It's not great.
I remember when acid rain started being in the public conscious, I think it was back in the late 80s, It made it sound, at least when I was a kid, I was like, it made it sound like this was going to be the end of the world, and this was going to be very detrimental, and society would essentially collapse from what we knew it as, because the acid rain would basically ruin everything and ruin ecosystems. So I feel this regreening effort that we'll talk about in a little bit, you know, has been very positive overall, because I don't remember in the last like 10 or 15 years anyone really mentioning acid rain in a incredibly negative context.
Or similarly to your comment on a previous episode about your kid brain not understanding, I believe that was the asbestos episode, you thought that's what people said when they sneezed. I thought that acid rain was like battery acid raining down, and that if it touched our skin, we would be burned and it would destroy everything, not because it's acidic, but because it would burn everything. I thought acid rain was acid in its most extreme form. And as I got older, I realized that there is a pH scale, acid being one extreme and base being the other extreme. And acid rain is leaning more on the acid side of that scale. And obviously there's varying degrees if the acid can be, you know, more concentration. But yeah, I was just thinking back to that and I was like, oh, that was silly. It's not battery acid raining down, Nicole. Anyways, in 1991, the US and Canada signed an air quality agreement known as the Acid Rain Accord to reduce threats to forest and fisheries in the US and Canada. As of 2010, 9.2 million new trees have been planted. In current day Vail, previously Inco, is rehabilitating slag heaps surrounding the smelter and planting grass and trees, as well as using biosolids to stabilize and regreen tailing areas. Restoring the ecosystem has taken decades and it is still ongoing. And honestly, at this point, I hope that it's ongoing forever. I think this is something that needs, at least you're going to eventually get to a maintenance phase, but you still need ongoing attention to make sure that we don't slide back into the environment that we were in previously with all of the pollution. In addition to revitalizing the area, mining companies also sought to reduce and capture their emissions. And their work's not done. Almost a century of mining and smelting have led to millions of tons of reactive mine waste materials that contaminate food and drinking water throughout the area. And so in addition to the regreening, this requires additional monitoring and management by industry and hopefully some oversight to avoid undoing the revitalization that the community has worked so hard for.
So there you have it, the Sudbury effect. Undoing a century of damage little by little, and what went from green and lush to black and barren, back to green again. Sudbury is now said to have the cleanest air of any city in Ontario.
Thanks for listening to this mini failure episode. For regular episodes, check out Failurology wherever you get your podcasts. If you want to chat with us, our Twitter handle is @Failurology. You can email us at thefailurologypodcast@gmail.com. You can connect with us on LinkedIn, or you can message us right in the Patreon app. There are links to all of these in the show notes. Bye, everyone. Talk soon.